Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today we're talking about cinema for the dark season. The weird, the queer, and the noir. If you've been huddled up indoors lately, avoiding the rain and the gloom, well, now is your chance to step outside and treat yourself to the bright glow of the silver screen with your fellow cinephiles. I got some of them here with me. Micah Vanderhoof is in the studio. Micah is the theater manager for the Northwest Film Center and a programmer for some upcoming genre series that are coming to the big screen. Some edgy genre series, so get ready for that. And Greg Hamilton is back with us. Greg is a documentarian, all-around great guy, and friend to all your favorite independent filmmakers. Micah and Greg, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, Conch.
Thanks for having us.
And Greg, you have brought a friend with you, sort of. John Dahl will be in town, but right now he's on the line with us. And John is the director of many films, including Rounders, Unforgettable, The Last Seduction, and the modern noir masterpiece, Red Rock West. John Dahl, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Fantastic to have you here. Well, I've got Greg here to sort of tell the listeners a little intro about what the term neo-noir kind of refers to here.
Well, to start out with, I'd like to tell everybody about the event that's going to be coming up here. We're bringing John up from L.A. to screen his film Red Rock West over at the Hollywood Theater on Saturday, January 18th at 7 p.m. And it's a real privilege to have him up here to show this film. It was very influential on me early on, and I know that it made an impact on a lot of people. John, what do you think about the influence of noir on your work, of film noir on your work?
I guess I kind of got into it by, I was an art student in Missoula at the University of Montana, and I was walking by a used book sale one day, and I saw all these old Pulp Fiction covers on books. One of them was I Wake Up Screaming, you know, those old kind of like pulpy books. And I guess the first thing that I fell in love with was the artwork on the covers and the titles. And that just kind of like lodged in my brain a little bit. And then years later, as I started, you know, studying film at Montana State University, and I took a trip to San Francisco on a bus, and we stopped in the town of Reno, Nevada. And a kid from Montana, having never been in Reno, Nevada, and walking around and realizing that you could gamble and drink and do all kinds of things 24/7 was kind of mind expanding for a kid from Montana. And that kind of lodged in my brain. And then years later, when I started getting into film, I was sitting in a, I was watching the great, maker of Sunset Boulevard and Double Indemnity. And I'm blanking on his name right now, but you probably know his name. He won like 8 Academy Awards. He also did Ace in a Hole. And Some Like It Hot. Now, this is really embarrassing because I can't remember his name. But anyway, a great filmmaker. And I'm sitting there watching Double Indemnity, and my dad was in the insurance business, and I never really realized that the insurance business could be quite as sexy and interesting as Double Indemnity, with Fred McMurray playing the part of an insurance salesman talking to this sultry vixen, Barbara Stanwyck.
Billy Wilder, that was the one.
Yeah, Billy Wilder.
A Raymond Chandler script.
Yeah. So I'm sitting there, and I'm realizing that I'm living in Los Angeles, and I start looking around, and I see, and there enough, the Aldo Nido Hotel is still there at the top of, like, it's near, kind of if you're, you know, where the Capitol Record Tower is, it's like 2 blocks west of there, this old hotel that William Holden lived in Sunset Boulevard, and I'm living near Normandy and Vermont, you know, like the neighborhood that story took place in, and this is back in the 70s and 80s, and it was really impossible to find a movie unless it was playing on television. This is even before videotapes. Then as I when I'm in school in 1982. Of course, I was only 12 years old at the time, but that was a joke. I realize I'm not talking to an audience. Sorry. Anyway, I just kind of fell in love with that type of movie. And around that time, there was this great video store in Santa Monica called Vidiots. And videotape came, you could get a VHS and you could watch any movie you wanted. Back in the early 80s, there was still rerun house. There was rerun houses in Los Angeles, these great theaters, like the Vista Theater on a corner of Vermont. And a lot of them are still there, but they have to do other kinds of events. But actually, that's where I saw Once Upon a Time in the West on film for the first time. But great experiences of watching movies. I actually saw Double Indemnity on film the first time. Seeing these great movies and then kind of realizing, I should just, I love these kind of stories. I should maybe try to make something that's from where I grew up, in Montana, because, Montana's like, what is it, I think it's the fourth largest state in the country. It's huge. Size-wise, yeah. But it's so small. I think there's still less than a million people there. In fact, they even took away one of our congresspersons.
You're supposed to get it back soon.
I don't think it works that way. California's got 22 of them, and they're never going the other way. But in other words, there's more senators in Montana than there are congresspeople. So it's... when you drive across the state, there's all this vast, wide open spaces. And in a way, to me, growing up as a kid, that's almost more terrifying than walking down a scary street at night in New York City. There's just something about being in the middle of nowhere. Should you happen to run across, some unsavory character, you're really on your own. So it was all those kinds of things that kind of led towards, I'll make my own noir story from Montana and based on, my first movie was called Kill Me Again, which was kind of like that wake up screaming kind of, like that sort of noir-y pulpy sort of thing, which just, I wasn't really thinking about noir that much, but I knew that I kind of liked all that lighting and the stories is what I was really attracted to, these like sort of imperfect human beings sort of like trying to struggle and get ahead in life and failing miserably.
So one question I have for you, John, is when you went into when you were in the process of getting ready to produce and direct Red Rock West, when you were casting for it, you came across Nick Cage, and the there's a retrospective that this film is part of that's of Cage Films called Cage Uncaged. Can you talk a little bit about how Nick Cage came to the film and what it was like to work with him on set?
Absolutely. We were kind of, the first movie I did, Kill Me Again, which was, again, set in Reno, Nevada, kind of a noirish sort of like, how do you make a noir story in Montana? Well, you move it to Nevada because Nevada is scarier than Montana at sometimes. Red Rock West came out of a location scout in Nevada where I walked into a bar and came up with the idea of walking into a bar and meeting somebody that could, wanted to kill their wife. So that was really sort of the generation of Red Rock West, my second film. But when it came to my film, Kill Me Again, got screened in like two major markets, and one of those happened to be San Francisco. And fortunately, for some strange reason, Coppola, Nick's uncle, saw the movie. And when we had sent the script to Nick, he came in and he said, "Yeah, my uncle saw your movie. He said it was interesting. So I read the script and I like it." And, Nick was really, more of a comedic actor, but, he's kind of has sort of a great edge to him. We were, of course, thrilled to get him, and he's an amazing actor. And, I think on the first day on the set, we were shooting that scene where he pulls into that gas station And I learned a very valuable lesson that day. So he walks in, and we're shooting that scene, and we come out, and he's, you know, I'm not really, you know, giving him a lot of notes, and he's doing this thing, and I since then have realized that the best thing to do when it's working really well, just say nothing. Because we were outside shooting that scene where he's putting gas in the, you know, the old man's, you know, like actually you have an attendant that actually pump your gas. That's how old this movie is.
Well, come to Oregon.
Yeah. So, and it was probably 50 cents a gallon too. But anyway, so he's, so we're shooting the scene, and I said, yeah, Nick, that was really, and I liked that little chuckle that you did. On the next take, the chuckle became bigger. On the third take, it was like a huge laugh. On the fourth take, it was like a hilarious laughter. And I realized, I should just keep my mouth shut when I like something. And at one point, and then like the next day or two, he said, I think, which was really an interesting, and I used this again later in the movie. He said, I think I'm supposed to be Clint Eastwood in this movie, right? And I said, yeah. And that was, you know, and he kind of got into that sort of stoic, quiet, you know, sort of performance I was going for. And then at one point, he does that scene where he realizes that he's bamboozled by Wayne and the girl and Suzanne, and she says, we can go to Mexico. And he just like screams out. And I can't say what he actually says, probably on the air.
Yeah.
It's a four letter word, Mexico. And he bursts out. And I remember thinking, wow, that's really big. But at the same time, he'd been so bottled up and so reserved and so stoic through the whole movie. And he had just finished doing that movie, which is hilarious. The one where he's an Elvis Presley impersonator, or he's jumping out of an airplane in Las Vegas. Like this wildly crazy comedic movie, which he was great in. And we just kept it because it was kind of so great. So it kind of like worked in the movie because he'd been so like reserved and quiet the whole time that one outburst when he's realized that he's been completely screwed over by these people worked well.
Well, Nicolas Cage, for you, I mean, that was a factor of you being admired by Francis Ford Coppola, but it really works well with your whole line of work is you manage the tension with humor. You take these noirs, you know, the original noirs that you loved from the 30s and 40s, and you were pretty much a pioneer of the whole neo-noir thing in the 80s and 90s. But you know, here it is. You set it out in a Western landscape, and then you throw in two of the craziest actors you can think of, Nicolas Cage and Dennis Hopper, like going up against each other. You know, with Lara Flynn Boyle just for good measure. You know, I mean, this is like the dream project for so many directors nowadays. But you know, as you said, you sat back a little bit. You like let them do their magic, and in some cases you kind of almost let them create the scenes. But yeah,
right.
the whole time like that's kind of your hallmark is letting the tension build and letting it become almost unbearable, and then getting the audience to just laugh at something that is just so absurd.
Yes. Well, I'm glad you like that, because I mean I've always thought that movies are more fun when you're laughing. You know, like a big, you know, clearly a big movie for me when I saw it when I was still, I was just getting out of film school, was Blood Simple. And I just thought it
Coen
was
Brothers,
hilarious.
Yes.
Yes, I just thought it was hilarious. I'd never seen anything like that. I just thought it was hilarious. I remember thinking, this guy is wiping up blood on the floor with a windbreaker. He's an idiot. Doesn't he know that that's not absorbent? He should get a towel, you know, but that's, and I love that in movies that make me really uncomfortable because people are doing, you know, because that's kind of life. You know, I had an experience as a kid where I grew up, there was an irrigation ditch that went through town and you were not supposed to be in it, but we'd all jump in it and swim in it during the summertime. and this friend of mine and I were in the ditch, and a police car came over this bridge, and clearly he stopped and saw us, and we had nowhere to go, so we were hiding on along the bank, and you know, we're like 18, we're hiding along the bank, and we can hear the cop coming up the hillside, and I look over at my friend and I pretend like I'm going to sneeze. I don't know why I did that. I just thought it was funny, you know, because and I was always reminded, you know, I think that people react under pressure in a different way, you know, and it's like you see these, you know, I love that in movies where you see something that you don't expect to have happen, something that's just, you know, like a little character bit. And it's, I think, you know, in a way we all, you know, we all have a sense of humor. We laugh at the inappropriate times, and I'm glad that you noticed that in the movies.
Well, you've been, for the past decade or so, you've been really focusing not so much on feature films anymore, but on television work. You've directed episodes of Breaking Bad, True Blood, House of Cards, and all of these have that same earmark that you're famous for, of having these wonderful absurdist moments in the middle of almost, almost impossible tension. So are you one of those directors who feels like television is really where the freedom is nowadays to kind of cut loose, like Hollywood has a little too much restraint on feature films and TV is really the auteur's medium now?
I do think that, and that the, you know, the process of, you know, I mean, I recognize these are multi-million dollar, you know, small businesses that you're creating, and that the people that are paying for them, you know, are obviously expecting a commercial and sellable product at the end of it. And that's sort of like the fun of the independent movies of the 90s is kind of like, you know, I mean, look what's happening in the theater right now. It's very hard to get an independent film made. I'd be thrilled to make a movie for $650,000 because there's a break even point in the SAG contract. You know, it's just like, it's very hard to even, you know, get the smallest movies made. And around the time that I had done this movie with, a movie called You Kill Me with Taye Leone, and she had, and it was really fun, and it was a small little movie. And after that, after we'd wrapped, she called me and said, you know, David, my husband, Duchovny, is going to make a TV series. I can't believe he's doing television again. And he was asking if he'd like to direct an episode. And that was Californication. And so I showed up and I read this hilarious script. I thought, wow, they're really making this stuff. And this is on Showtime, which I think is a great network, and they do pretty incredible work. I prep it for 4 days, I shoot for 5 days, and I edit it in a day and a half.
Wow!
And I'm done. And you know, and here I am. I've been working on putting together this small movie for like a year that my brother and I wrote. And then I get a call, you know, and I just, and this is about the time, it's like a de facto writer's strike, and I'm getting, you know, and then I was called to do an episode of True Blood, and I did an episode of Breaking Bad, and then I did an episode of Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, yeah.
Like, within a few months, I'd done like a sex farce comedy in Los Angeles, a vampire story set in Louisiana, a Breaking Bad, which is a great show set in New Mexico, and a space show, which, you know, I would never get to do that kind of that breadth of work in just a space of like a few months. Oh, and I also did an episode of Dexter.
Ah.
I was just like, you know, this is kind of amazing. I'll do television while I'm trying to put together, you know, my next feature film, and I should actually be on a film set.
It sounds like the old days. Sounds like the old days of the studio system when
exactly. And that's, you know, and it's like I realized, you know, like I can be on set with all these really, you know, because there's a lot of really good talented writers in television, And there's also a lot of really talented actors, because the pressures in the, are much different. You know, like you kind of, these people, they make a pilot. If they like the pilot, I mean, I've sat in like 100 test screenings just for the move, just for the 8 movies that I've done, you know. And this is an exhausting process of putting the movie together, taking it to an audience, which I actually really like. That's the best part about it. And actually, one of the worst parts about television is that they don't really, you know, that television, you know, studios and producers don't really interact that much with an audience. I guess they do in a way, because they just look at their results every time they run the show. But there's something really, like, it's a full contact sport sitting in a room with an audience. And it's just, and as a filmmaker, and again, I had the great good fortune of going to the American Film Institute, and there was this brilliant exercise that they would do. You'd make your short film, you'd bring it in, and all the students would be sitting there, and they'd watch the film, and then the instructor, the great Tony Villani, would ask you to come down and sit in front of the audience, and you'd have to sit there, and then everybody was allowed to like say whatever they wanted, and you weren't allowed to talk at all. And his thinking was, look, you took my time. I spent the last 20 minutes watching your show. I don't care if the grip truck was late. I don't care if the actor was a jerk. I don't care about any of that stuff. You showed, you presented what you presented, and now you need to hear what people thought of it. And you couldn't really defend yourself at all. And you just had to sit there and listen. And it's a great way for filmmakers to understand that you're kind of making this collective art form, and you're allowing an audience to sit there and take away what they can from what you've created. And, you know, if you get 60, 70, 80% of what you meant to get across to an audience, then you're succeeding. But you can't really, make excuses for what you didn't get.
It's a conversation. It's not quite as direct a conversation as live theater, but it's a conversation, all right.
Yes, absolutely. And it's a great experience. And that's why, you know, given the opportunity to go, and I've had the, like one of my favorite films, Billy Wilder films, I got to show it, they call it, they do this bake off in the summertime for like films, and they ask people to present a film. And I got to watch An Ace in the Hole with an audience at the AFI. And it was hilarious. I've seen that movie like 4 times by myself sitting on the couch. And to get to watch it with an audience was great, because people are laughing, they're having a great time. Everything just resonates better. So there's really something about that audience experience.
Yeah, and we're going to get a chance, and John Dahl, we're going to get a chance to interact with you at the screening of Red Rock West on the 18th of the month at 7 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater. And you're going to be doing a Q&A as well here in Portland.
Absolutely. I love it. It's always a joy to be able to watch a film with a group of people. It's a much better experience.
You can get some great feedback. Yeah. And Greg, how can our listeners find out more about these events that are going on?
You can get tickets over at hollywoodtheater.org. Tickets are going quickly. We've sold probably about half of the house already. So if you want to get out there and see John on the 18th, get out there and check the site.
And John, yeah, it's going to be a pleasure to have you here. And it's been a great pleasure to have you on Words and Pictures. We really appreciate talking with you today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm S.W. Conser. You're listening to Words and Pictures. We're talking about independent genre films for the dark season with Greg Hamilton, John Dahl, and Micah Vanderhoof. And Micah, we want to ask you about your series that's coming up. It's called Underscan, Originally Head Cleaner, in reference to the old VHS tape era. Tell us about what's coming up at the Film Center, the Northwest Film Center at the Portland Art Museum.
Yeah. So we've got a number of cool films coming up. Underscan is sort of a thematic review of cult and genre films with kind of a eye towards marginalized stories and just things that are kind of a little bit outside of the regular cult and genre canon. Actually this Saturday we have Faster Pussycat Kill Kill coming up at 7 p.m. And we were like really like hoping to be able to get the 35mm print, and we were able to get it kind of last minute. So this is like a little bit late.
The way God intended, the 35mm.
Nice.
And this is sometimes considered sexploitation. This is Russ Meyer, some 60s and 70s. indie stuff that's it's really out there?
It's definitely, I think it basically is sexploitation. It's just, I like in the spirit of, you know, the death of the author, I'm very pro reinterpreting and seeing this as kind of from the women, the go-go dancers' perspective, like, they're just kind of trying to live their lives and, like, have fun. And, like, all these people are just trying to keep them down. And, you know, like, who doesn't want to go create mayhem in the salt flats of California? So I think there's it's a really fun show. And we're going to have a great time re-examining it, I think.
And then sympathy for totally insane artists. You have multiple maniacs.
Yeah, we've got John Waters on the 19th, Multiple Maniacs, early one of his films, but featuring Divine nonetheless, going just into complete revenge debauchery mode. And that's also, so all of these films are usually on Sunday at 7. The Faster Pussycat Kill is going to be on Saturday, kind of unusually, to make room for the Julia Reichardt retrospective that's also taking
place. Oh, yeah, we want to talk about Julia Reichardt, but first, there's a really rare film.
Yeah, then Sunday after that, the 26th, we've got Madam X, An Absolute Ruler, which is Ulrika Oettinger's film from 78. That's her first feature, and it's like a lesbian pirate film. Madam X, her frequent collaborator Tabea Blumenschein, is this amazing, like, siren-like pirate queen who makes this call out to just women everywhere to get them to ditch their boring lives and come join her on this amazing lesbian pirate ship. And it's very arty, very kind of Jodorowsky-esque in terms of its art design approach and scope, basically.
Kind of like the female version of El Topo, then, huh?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay.
And then in February, we've got Bound is the last one of the series. Ooh. And so, like, the theme for these is queer crime films, basically.
Bound, early Wachowski brothers who went on to do the Matrix films.
Definitely.
But and Julia Reichardt is coming to town. She is a criminally underknown filmmaker who has some really transformative films out there.
Yeah. Really sort of labor, class consciousness oriented films, documentaries primarily, and just has had a very long and vast career over the past 50 years. We actually have her coming on the 12th. She's going to be giving a lecture on her life in film. It's called Life in Film. the lecture's at 5 o'clock. We're going to have, like, a little reception at 6:30, and then we're screening her documentary American Factory at 7:30. So if you get a ticket to American Factory, you can come to the lecture. It's kind of all inclusive package deal. She'll be here, and I'm sure taking questions and stuff like that.
And how can listeners find out more about the lineup at the Northwest Film Center?
Yeah, just go check it out on our website, which is nwfilm.org.
Well, thank you so much, Greg Hamilton, John Dahl, and Micah Vanderhoof, for joining us in the studio today to talk about films for the dark season. You've been listening to Words and Pictures on KABU. I'm SW Conser. Thanks to all our listeners today on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. And thanks to the Oregon Media Production Association for their support and collaboration. The audio for this show will be available later today on our archive page, kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And you can keep up with us on Twitter, @wordsandpicture.